Today is not an ordinary day, nor are we celebrating an ordinary anniversary. Not even ordinary in the sense of military anniversaries. Not even ordinary in the sense of anniversaries of disasters. For what happened 5 years ago today was a defining moment in civilization, galvanizing not only to governments but to peoples as much as the Pearl Harbor attack in December of 1941. This event was best summarized in the words of an Arab-American psychologist named Wafa Sultan, who said that this date unleashed a new struggle, a clash not between regular armies, but between competing opposites, competing eras, a clash between a mentality that belongs to the Middle Ages and another mentality that belongs to the 21st century, a clash between civilization and backwardness, between the civilized and the primitive, between barbarity and rationality. It is a clash between freedom and oppression, between democracy and dictatorship, between human rights on the one hand and the violation of these rights on the other hand. And that is why today is so important. It reminds us that the struggle we are engaged in today with Islamic fundamentalism is not a struggle against any modernist version of the past politics of assassination. This is not about the killing of particular people thought to be guilty of particular acts. This is not about people who have some root causes or grievances, for most of the terrorists belong to the ruling classes of the countries they are from. This terror is random murder and thuggery, and that is the war we are engaged in. It is a radical transformation of past practices of political violence characterized by unknown victims, innocent of any act. And we have a debt to those victims, and we have a debt to ourselves to bear memory and witness. For the Islamo-fascists we now fight in this current world war that began 5 years ago today have emptied the category of the innocent. They claim butchery as their right, slaughter as their legacy. And the deep moral and political significance of this change has been too often and too consciously ignored by those in the West pandering to Islamist blackmail. And this could have graver consequences because of the deep-rooted cowardice of response in the media and academe. Great revolutionary named Leon Trotsky once said that the revolution must have a code of honor. This does not mean that previous revolutionaries were necessarily good or gentle people, but they realized limits on violent action. Everything was not permissible for a very practical reason, as Trotsky went on to say, that the revolution should not be loathed by the whole human race. And if we are to be human, and if we are to maintain our humanity, we need to loathe the enemy we fight today. We're devoting the whole hour to remembering 9/11, to remembering the memory, the witness, the pain, the lessons learned, and what we need to do to go forward. And we're going to go around the world. From Washington, we're going to be joined by James Woolsey, former director of the CIA, and co-chair of the Committee on the Present Danger. From Ottawa, General Lewis McKenzie. From London, Colonel Peter Reynolds, who was Director of Public Affairs at NATO headquarters at the time of the 9/11 attack and has subsequently been an advisor to the United Nations Office of Project Services overseeing the Iraqi elections. And from Jerusalem, we'll be joined by David Harrell, who was Vice President for Security, International Security Affairs of the Israel Security Agency with special responsibility for aviation. And we'll be back with our first guest right after this.
Montreal, we're back, and our first guest this evening is the man who I always say took out a good deal of the storehouse of reason and sanity from Washington when he left, the former CIA director and vice president of Booz Allen Hamilton, R. James Woolsey. Jim Woolsey, thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Sure, bro. Good to be with you.
This is a special program on remembering 9/11. Part of it is memory, part of it is what we learn, and part of it obviously is how we change the world. So I got to ask you, that day, where were you, and where did you find out about it, and what was happening with you?
I was in a meeting advising a Navy a couple of miles south of the Pentagon, and someone had seen on CNN the first plane hit, and then when the second plane hit, they wheeled the television into the meeting, and we all were stunned for a few minutes, realized it was terrorism. left, meeting broke up, people going different ways. I started to drive home, and as I left the Navy meeting, I heard a very loud crash, and it was, I'm sure, the plane going into the Pentagon a couple of miles away.
And you heard that from where you...
Oh, yeah, I could even sort of feel the air shock effect. I went by and filled up on gasoline, and then I went to a hospital to try to give blood. And while I was there, because I thought there'd be a lot of casualties at the Pentagon, and while I was there, got a call myself from my secretary who said, your sons are all fine. The one called from New York, and two of mine lived in New York, but nowhere near the Trade Center. And I didn't think that the third one was visiting. I knew he was visiting them, but I didn't know he'd be anywhere near the Trade Center. As it turned out, he came out of the subway just after several minutes after the second built tower was hit. And there was a lot of rubble around. He didn't know what it was, and he was standing looking at it, and either a policeman or a firefighter, he's not sure which, ran up to him and said, get out. And being my son, he started to argue. And the first responder spun him around and shoved him to the door and said, get out now. And Ben and a friend of his were carrying luggage, and they started walking and jog down the street. The South Tower collapsed right behind them, and they had to race the rubble and dust down the street to get away. And the police officer or firefighter who got him out of the building certainly died.
So this was a personal day, a personal tragedy for you on several levels. This wasn't just theory at that point.
Well, I mean, I was lucky in a sense because we didn't have any idea that our son was anywhere near the World Trade Center until we knew he was all right. So we didn't have a period in which we thought he might have been killed or hurt. But it's very personal with me as well as being a major matter of the national priority.
3 years ago at a conference of ours at the Institute of Public Affairs, you laid out the thesis that this was World War III, if not World War IV, World War III. You called the Cold War. You used Elliot Cohn's thesis. Did that formulation, was that in your mind on 9/11/2001?
Probably not. I got the idea from Elliot, who wrote a piece called World War IV in the Wall Street Journal a week or two after.
But you and your colleagues, by 2001, your friends in the intelligence community and the senior levels of government had already lived through the coal and the bombing of embassies. Was there a feeling that this was a new, strange kind of enemy that operating independently and sometimes had a center core, that this was a true identifiable war?
Yes, very much. I served on the National Terrorism Commission that reported in, late 2000, that Jerry Bremer actually chaired, and we had a list of 25 recommendations on strengthening things related to counterterrorism, nobody was interested except one senator, Senator John Kyle of Arizona, who held some hearings and tried to get a bill through and got nowhere in the Senate, and the House didn't consider it, and the administration didn't consider it. Basically, until 9/11, I think the United States was living in the post-Cold War era, and it was sort of like the Roaring Twenties after the victory in World War I. The stock market was up. Hey, let's party. Hit the beach. That was the national mood until 9/11. It's very, very hard to get anybody's attention for even the most minimally sensible things to do.
We live in a time of instant gratification where people want instant results, instant victories, instant analysis. But this is a new kind of war. It's about protecting structures that are being put in place. And you tell a story once of when you got into a cab in Washington and the cab driver turned to you and said, Mr. Woolsey, they're not attacking us for anything we do wrong. They're attacking us for what we do right.
Yes.
Live free. How is that message getting across successfully to the American people and indeed to the Canadian people as well, continentally?
I don't know about there in Canada, but here only spottily. I think a lot of people are of the view, what have we done wrong? Why do they hate us? Maybe if we changed our policy toward Israel, maybe if we got out of Iraq, they'd leave us alone. I think that's nonsense. I think that shows weakness, and weakness is the main thing you don't want to show in the face of theocratic totalitarian fanatics like these guys.
Glenn Beck asked the question consistently on his show on CNN. What is it, Mr. and Mrs. America, that you don't understand by the words of the Ahmadinejads and the Bin Ladens? They want to create a theocracy, a caliphate on the West. Why don't people take these guys at their words? Why do they always come up with excuses for them?
Well, look at what was going on in the 1930s. The Manchester biography of Churchill,
yes.
Great classic, Volume 2, which deals with Churchill in the late 20s and up until he took over as prime minister in May of 1940, mainly the 30s, has a one-word title, Alone. And, boy, was that right. He was alone in Britain. It was by the narrowest chance that he became a prime minister, really with Chamberlain's backing by that point.
Yes.
It's very hard for democracies to get themselves out of this mood that, you know, if you just make nice with folks, things will be fine. And generally speaking, among democracies, that's right.
That's because democracies don't go to war with each other.
Yeah, they don't. And, you know, we in Canada get into an argument about lumber and quotas and tariffs and so forth. We'll get it sorted out. I mean, we may have been too pig-headed for too long on that, but we'll get it sorted out, and we'll talk about it. But that's between democracies, and with totalitarians, it's very different. Someone once told me there's a wonderful quote from Martin Luther King. You remember Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the
yes.
Protestant minister who was a pacifist and participated in the plot to assassinate Hitler and was killed by the Nazis just a few days before the end of World War II in Europe. Somebody asked King, you know, how should we deal with international matters? And he said, well, if your enemy has a conscience, imitate Gandhi. If he doesn't have a conscience, imitate Bonhoeffer.
Very good.
I think that sort of says it all. Sometimes you got to fight.
That's correct. And it's not all about peace. It's about being free. Peace unconditionally is no peace at all. Jim Woolsey, thanks for taking the time to be with us tonight. And as they said about Churchill, as long as there are people like you that can marshal language and take it out to war, we've got more than a fighting chance.
Well, kind of. Good to talk to you.
Take care, Jim.
Bye-bye.
We'll be right back.
Well, if Jim Woolsey, as I said, took out much of the storehouse of reason and sanity from Washington when he left, our next guest holds much of the character and conscience of our nation. It is always a pleasure to welcome General Lewis McKenzie. Lou McKenzie, welcome. Thanks for spending some time with us tonight.
Cheers, Beryl. Thanks.
Before I share something with you that drove me absolutely crazy this weekend about how Canada and Canadians react to things, we're going through reminiscences and we're going through lessons learned. Where were you on 9/11? When the news hit?
Yeah, a little bit bizarre, actually, because I was driving past on Highway 400 past Barrie with my wife on my way to my motor racing sponsor for a meeting, which was Rogers in those days, and I had the radio on. I flicked the radio on, and they were talking about the World Trade Center, and I turned to my wife and said, this isn't the 10th anniversary of the attack in the World Trade Center, the explosions in the underground parking lot. I mean, this is bizarre. I mean, what are they doing this for? It was at least 10 minutes before I realized it was reality. And when I got to Rogers, I didn't see any pictures, but I got off on the 13th floor, and there are 24 television sets on the wall, all with the same picture. The towers haven't come down yet. There are about 50 people staring at these television monitors, and nobody's saying a word. I go in to see my friend who I deal with in my motor racing sponsorship, and the first tower came down. I mean, it was information overload. There was no doubt about that. So, you know, I was in the Middle East in Gaza when Kennedy was assassinated, and this one would come in as number two.
Right.
I remember exactly what I said and what I was doing at that time.
You've often said and you've written of how bean counters are in danger of taking over our national character. And I wanted to share something with you that drove me crazy in terms of Canadians' reactions and this debate we're having now on the Afghanistan mission.
Mm-hmm.
This weekend in the Globe and Mail, there was a review of a book about the murder of Dutch filmmaker Theo van Gogh.
Right.
And the reviewer of the book said the following. He said that the writer of the book could think of, quote, no solutions to our current problems with Islamic fundamentalism. And then the reviewer went on to say, instead of asking, you know, so why bother writing the book? The reviewer, in typically politically correct Canadian fashions, went on to compliment the author with the following accolade. This is not a weakness, but a credit, for it is proof of his intellectual honesty. I don't know about you, Lou McKenzie, but if weakness be honesty, then maybe this nation needs rogues with courage. How do we get out of this stupefying mindset?
Well, and we've only just recently taken a tentative step back on the stage of, with the rest of the many of the international community, and already we have people going wobbly, like Mr. Layton and some of his.
Oh, concert. Can you believe this?
Well, and
you know, I'd love to know what Jumpin' Jack Flash Layton wants to negotiate with the Taliban about. They hate socialists. They murder gays. They degrade women. They can't. They disallow trade unionists. What are you going to talk to them about?
When you have the luxury of being this little nation tucked off in a corner of paradise, everything can be local politics, and you know as well as I
yep.
am that he's playing local politics, and that's
the lowest common denominator of slime.
That's despicable, but it's the reality, because we can get away with that. If I've answered one question today once, I've answered it 10 times. Are we safer today than we were back in 9/11? And I think it's a really dumb question, because it doesn't consider that 9/11 happened, and therefore, what if we had done nothing after 9/11? Absolutely zero. Would we be better off than we are today? And I think the answer has to be overwhelmingly no. We have taken action. All the actions by the international community weren't necessarily well received. They weren't necessarily contributing to more security. But overall, by way of security and border crossing and financial controls, et cetera, yeah, we are better off. But there's a whole whack of folks out there that say, no, it's Bush's world and it's more dangerous. And well, it's only Bush's world because of 9/11. And the American requirement to do something about it.
You know, and another thing that drives me a bit crazy is how Canadians like to talk about terrorism and what is the definition and who says what it is. And if you could stay with us during this short break, I want to go over just a few points of this from the military perspective.
Yep.
Montreal, we'll be back with General Lewis McKenzie right after this. We're remembering 9/11 tonight, not just the memory and witness of the horror, but the lessons learned. And our special guest right now is General Lewis McKenzie. Lou McKenzie, before the break, I wanted to ask you something that just makes me a bit crazy when I hear discussions of it. And as a military man, I want you to tell me where I'm wrong. There's this whole debate that's going on now that's arising again in the media about what is terrorism and who says, and one man's terrorist is another guy's freedom fighter. But that is simply, to me, absolutely fatuous and a perversion of reality.
Mm-hmm.
Terrorism does not is not the essence of terrorism. Put aside the fact that terrorists don't fight in regular uniform. Seeks the destruction of civilians by rule, not exception. That terrorists and terrorist activities are carried out by killers driven generally by psychotic and homicidal hatreds of peoples based not so much on political grievances, but on their victims' race, color, and creed. I mean, what is it that I'm missing in this debate about what terrorism is?
Well, I think probably injecting Afghanistan into it and what our troops are doing and the other 35 nations, I mean, I don't call that terrorism over there. That's force on force. That's counterinsurgency, I think, is the proper terminology. I'm with you. I think at the head of the list, the number one priority is targeting civilians, intentionally targeting civilians. And in the vast majority of cases, it's driven by a perverse ideology or interpretation of religion or whatever. That's what qualifies terrorism, you know, as terrorism to me, because that's the objective, to absolutely terrorize. And in the case of the Islamists, the radical Islamists, it's to convince the rest of us that fighting them is to no avail. We had better convert, and the sooner we convert, the better. And to take on, I think the term in Arabic is ghazwiya, which means spectacular rage. By spectacular rage shall they convince us to convert. And that was a term used, by the way, just before the planes went into the Twin Towers.
And we don't seem to just understand at face value what their words are. When Iran talks about a caliphate, when bin Laden, second-in-command al-Zawahiri, wants us to convert, they're telling us, hey, you go our way or the highway and we'll butcher you. And we've got all these apologists for these people. But we have no way of relatively less people or relatively less quiet voices that are prepared to stand up and say, hey, I want to be free, and for that I'm willing to fight.
Yeah, and I think that's because a lot of people didn't realize that the world did change significantly after 9/11. I shouldn't say that the world changed. People's knowledge of what was going on, people's interpretation of what was going on changed. I mean, the war was around long before 9/11, and it was a war to take on all the infidels, and it's been much more formally recognized, but we still have this, I'm not sure whether political correctness is the right term, but this reluctance to actually think that somebody out there wants to take us out just because we're not like them. And they couldn't care less about whether we're grandmothers or children or whatever. And even though it's a small percentage, of an extremely large population, and as a result, it does have an impact. It isn't a very dangerous world. I mean, your chances are, I'm grabbing figures now, but they're close to being right, 20 times more likely to die of lung cancer barrel if you're a smoker or a heart attack.
I don't inhale, Lou.
or a traffic accident. I mean, if I drive from here down to Ottawa, I'm much, much more likely to be killed in a traffic accident than stumble into some terrorist attack. But nevertheless, it's despicable because it targets civilians. And I remember during the war in Lebanon, the recent war in Lebanon, people would look at the box score and they'd say 800 of them were dead and only 40 Israelis. And I'm saying, hold it, just a second, go back about 4 or 5 years. There's been over 1,700 Israelis killed.
Right.
And where? In buses, in restaurants.
And what do we say about the Allied bombing of Dresden or the World War II? We killed five times as many civilian Germans as they did Brits or Americans. What does that mean?
Yeah, no, it's
like being penalized for protecting your population.
No, there is a certain naivety, which is a luxury, by the way, in spite of the fact I'm disappointed in the naivety amongst some of the population of my country, of which I'm very proud. The fact is that it's a luxury to be able to be that naive and actually get away with it.
General Lewis McKenzie, many thanks for being with us tonight.
Take care, Beryl.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
And from Ottawa, we go to London, and we're joined by Colonel Peter Reynolds. Peter, thank you for staying up so late.
It's my pleasure, Beryl.
You have particular expertise all over the place, in Europe, in the Balkans. You led battle commands. You were Director of Public Affairs at NATO at the time of 9/11. You have recently served as Special Advisor to the United Nations Office of Project Services. Where were you the day it happened?
I was sitting in my office in Mons watching the TV, watching it happening, and that was my moment of shock and awe. And I had difficulty dragging my American colleagues, firstly, to understand what was going on, because I then walked into the other offices and say, hey, you need to see this. And it was just it was a seriously bad day.
Peter, right after this short break, I want to come back with you, and I want you to tell us how things have changed in Western Europe and what the mindset of governments and security organizations were. Montreal will be right back after this. And we're remembering 9/11 today, not just the memory and the witness of it, but how it's changed governments, how it's changed tactics. We're talking with Colonel Peter Reynolds from London, who has done a hell of a lot, combat commander in the Balkans, director of public affairs for NATO at the time of 9/11, most recently special advisor to United Nations Office of Project Services during the Iraqi elections. And Peter, I was asking you before the break, how 9/11 changed strategic thinking in Europe?
Well, it certainly changed the pace of strategic thinking about terrorism. Don't forget, most European countries have been dealing over the previous 20, 30 years. In my own case, for example, in the UK, we've been dealing with the IRA for that period of time. Spain had to deal with the Basque, and to some extent are still dealing with it today. Brigada Rossa had been seen off in Italy. Rote Brigade in Germany, you know, certainly kept their authorities busy for some time. But it certainly quickened the pace, and it was the first time that there was, you know, full-on al-Qaeda.
Was there an understanding that this terror, that this attack, practiced by actors that are non-state actors, was specifically for the purposes of state, in quotations, national aggression and acquisition, not for any purpose of self-determination or grievances?
No, I don't think it was initially. I saw something very interesting on the TV tonight, which was a program which showed the Will video of one of the tube bombers from London, you will recall, not so long ago.
Right.
And his fundamental aim was that the sooner we in England accept Sharia law, the better it'll be for us.
I couldn't believe, you know, three Saturdays ago in London, the demonstration that had restore the caliphate. I mean, it's just there now. They're printing signs, support the caliphate.
Yeah, and it does tend to worry me on occasion.
On a 1 to 10 scale of optimism being 10 and pessimism being 1, on a question of national will, where are you in terms of Europe?
I think it is becoming clearer, and we're moving towards the higher end of the scale as we speak. I think a lot of people are, now that they're seeing some of these wheel videos and have seen the results of the attacks in their own countries, it has caused some of the scales to drop off the eyes.
General Peter Reynolds, thanks very much for taking some time out to be with us tonight. I know it's late in London. Go have a good night's sleep.
I certainly will.
Take care.
Good time. Bye.
And we have Brian from NDG with us. Brian? Brian?
Yeah, is this Beryl?
Yeah.
Okay, I just wanted to say, I agree with you guys. I'm one of these people, I would rather see some peaceful efforts made or tried, but, I'll be the first one dancing on Bin Laden's grave when we finally get him,
Sweetheart, all well and good to have peaceful solutions, but you have to have somebody to talk with.
But the thing is, I'm not suggesting we talk to him, I'm suggesting we use other methods, like Israel was using against Hamas, with, like, covert action, special
yes.
ops. The thing is I'm hearing a lot of people saying that I'm a coward because I'm looking for other ways. You're asking me to commit my unborn great-grandchildren to a world of war, and then you're mocking me when I hesitate.
No, I'm not mocking you at all when you hesitate. I don't think anybody's giving anybody the option of committing or not committing. They're saying to you, we hate you for what you are, and there's nothing you're going to do to change that'll make us stop killing you.
I don't doubt that for a second. I agree 100% with you on that, but I just don't want to commit to perpetual war.
I think
I'd rather try a different way. I'd rather use, like I said, when Israel was using covert action.
More effective intelligence and covert and clandestine operations.
That's right.
Thank you very much, Brian. Montreal, we'll be right back.
Montreal, we're back. We're doing an evening of reminiscence today, a reminiscence and lessons about 9/11. And as a nation, perhaps few, though America suffered the casualties, perhaps few had its future as affected and its agenda changed as much as Israel. Our next guest, David Harrell, at the time was the head of international affairs and with a particular specialty in aviation security for the Israel Security Agency. He is now a vice president of Acera Worldwide Security, and we're very glad to have him with us. David Harrell, welcome.
Welcome and good evening.
David, where were you? And I'm starting off all the interviews tonight. Where were you when you heard about the Twin Towers attack?
Actually, I was on a senior management course at the ISA Academy when I had a message came in on my pager that a plane had just gone into one of the World Trade Towers, and I just had suddenly ideas. I was thought some kind of small Cessna plane had by accident crashed into the building, and didn't think much of it at the time. And then about 20, 25 minutes later, I think there was another message came in on my pager saying that another plane had hit. And then I realized something more serious was going on. We left the classroom and went down to one of the rooms where there was a television and where we saw all those horrific events unveiling before us. So I'll never forget that day, that's for sure.
Was there any chatter in the intelligence community in Israel prior to that time of a momentous attack by Al-Qaeda, by Bin Laden, of a momentous plan like this? The world had lived through the U.S.'s call, the embassy bombings. Israel was a main thoroughfare for intelligence getting even into the States. Was there any chatter? Was there any feeling that something really, really ugly was going to happen?
It was a sensitive period, but I can't really recall anything specific. Anyway, not relating to Israel.
What was the changes the next day? What was the first things that the Israeli intelligence community did in terms of its own regard or look at either Israeli security or the menace from the jihadists?
Well, we had to consider the event very seriously and understand the implications for us. And we immediately withdrew certain lessons from the events and tightened up where we could tighten up. And although our operations are considered probably one of the tightest in the world, we found the need to even tighten up even further.
That was on the ground at the airports, but what about the airspace of Israel? Was anything done with more regular patrols, with more regular flights around the perimeter of Israel to protect its airspace?
That was done as well. I'd rather not go into it at this stage.
Right. On the ground, day to day, more thought given to any little bit of intelligence in the days and weeks following 9/11? In Israel, every little tidbit that came in, did it take on a greater
intelligence,
gravity?
Intelligence always has to be taken seriously, but the fact of the matter is that most of attacks occur without intelligence. So it's not that's the big mistake. If you only rely on the intelligence coming in, then you're likely to be caught by surprise. You have to expect that the event will happen without intelligence. You have to have a good defense, even if you have a great offense as well. Offense being the intelligence side of it. Defense is your anti-terrorism and your anti-terrorism procedures. You have to have both for a winning team.
Could anyone have imagined an attack as audacious as this?
I would say the writing had been on the wall for quite some time. Unfortunately, in Operation Bojinka in 1995, when Ramzi Yosef and his accomplices intended to blow 11 U.S. planes out of the sky in midair, this act was thwarted. But the fact that back in 1995 there were groups that were even, we didn't know then, but were affiliated in some way to Al-Qaeda that were planning mass murder on a scale similar to 9/11. So if we had looked carefully at those events of Operation Bojinka and other events as well, even there was intel that came out of Manila after Ramzi Yosef was captured, about plans to dive planes, hijack planes into buildings, then I believe the writing had been on the wall, and although it shocked us all, it's difficult to imagine such a situation, and when you look back at it, you could see that the writing had been there on the wall.
And Ramzi Yosef, for our listeners who might not recognize the name, was the bomber and one of the masterminds behind the 93 bombing at the World Trade Center.
And he had intentions to assassinate the Pope during his visit to the Philippines. He probably was one of the most professional terrorists of our time.
What does that tell us today, and how do intelligence communities generally operate today? Are all the old divisions, it used to be thought that all these organizations operated separately because Al-Qaeda was Sunni, and today, for example, Iran is Shia, but do those divisions still hold, or is there now a commonality of interest among these groups and state actors that is going full out in a major, major offensive?
I would say there's more of a competition between the two of them rather than a communality. Listening to Azuhairi's tape today, I mean, you can see this is a clear attempt.
The number two man in Al-Qaeda.
That's right. This was obviously a clear attempt to bring the focus back onto the Sunni terrorism. Hezbollah had kind of upstaged them, and if you know a little bit about the tensions between the Sunni and the Shia, you can see that that there is a lot of tension there, and the Sunnis would like to change the situation following the war in Lebanon.
Merely to raise their profile and do more terror and show that they're still as powerful.
I would think so. I'm not sure that they still have the same capabilities, but the fact that he can get out these messages, which might act as an aspiration for other organizations, that's how it works today. He doesn't have to give direct orders, but by putting out a message, he might be able to attract people which will be inspired by the message and perhaps encouraged to do the thing that he's trying to achieve.
So we still have a lot of permutations and nuances in this new enemy that we face. It's the old Chinese curse. May we live in interesting times. It seems that we are.
Indeed.
David Harrell, thank you very much for joining us from Israel. I know it's late over there.
Always a pleasure, Bill.
Have a good night.
We've learned one thing tonight. We're in a new world, and it's going to test our character and our courage and our conscience. And it's time that we stop being confused and frightened and defensive and merely weakly indignant. It is these new barbarians who completely and consciously rejected any old codes of decency. And granted, those codes are nothing more than the most meager and minimal standards. But reasserting minimal standards would at this time in history already be a great advance for civilization. The least we must do is to marshal our resolve to revive our courage to loathe. It is only the first step to victory, but victory there will be. That is the promise of our memory and witness to the victims of that horrible day 5 years ago and of all the victims that followed. So, my friends, let us begin. We'll be back with you tomorrow night. Thank you to Chris Smith and Master Control.